You're listening to All Things Considered on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Time for our usual Friday discussion of politics. Rob Schofield of the Progressive NC Policy Watch is here, along with Becky Gray from the conservative John Locke Foundation. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hi, Jeff.
All right, hop on the nearest treadmill, crank it up, and hey, maybe add a blindfold for fun. Then you, too, can get a feel for the hazardous pace at which state lawmakers have moved this week. A couple of after-midnight sessions, dozens of bills moving quickly. During one House committee earlier this week, some bill sponsors were unable to answer questions about the bills they were, in fact, sponsoring. Lobbyists in the room were consulted to answer questions. Best case, this is brevity. Worst case, perhaps we're drifting into plutocratic waters. Becky, who are the beneficiaries of this?
That is a really good question. I guess the beneficiaries are, because it is moving at such a rapid pace, they should be finished soon. But what we're left with is still kind of up in the air. I don't know who the beneficiaries are. Jeff, this is something that has gone on. This isn't just this session. This isn't just this week. I mean, this is how the legislature functions. This is the system. Whether it's Republicans in charge or Democrats in charge, there is always this flurry, these late night sessions, stuff that comes out of nowhere that you don't know what it is. I mean, this is just the process, and it is maddening. It is frustrating. Then there's always sort of the hangover afterwards that I think all of us are probably going to be looking back through this stuff to find out what happened this week, even though we've been there all week.
Yeah, I would. You know, I've been coming to the General Assembly for 26 years now, and this is one of the worst I've seen. I looked at my email inbox earlier today on the day, looked at the past 24 hours, and I'd gotten 30 separate committee meeting notices in 24 hours. It's just coming at a mad rush. It's an insane flood. It's no way to make government. The people that are winning, as they have all session, are the leaders of the General Assembly, because they're writing these bills in secret. They're meeting them out whenever they feel like it. And for the most part, lawmakers are just passing them like sheep who, you know, nod in assent, and it goes forward. There's very little, except on a handful of bills, really intelligent, thoughtful debate, and even less ability for the public to participate.
And it seems like there are, certainly with some frequency, mistakes that are avoidable, maybe not nefarious and sinister, but mistakes that if you took a step back could be circumvented or adjusted before they get out in bills. Worth noting, due to our schedules, we're taping the segment on a Thursday afternoon. It is quite fluid this time of year, and things may have changed by the time you hear this conversation. So that's noted. On to early voting. Republicans have proposed shifting the final Saturday of early voting to a Wednesday on the front end. That final Saturday is moderately popular overall and one of the most used early voting days among black voters. Still, there are 18 different days on which voters can cast a ballot. Rob, how significant is this change and why?
It's just the latest, and it's very significant. It's just the latest in a long series of these voter suppression proposals from the Republicans running the General Assembly. They know exactly what they're doing. They know exactly what the impact will be. They know who it will affect. You know, the least they could have done, and this goes back to our conversation about how things are being rushed through at the last minute. This bill was unveiled in the middle of the night, sprung on everybody a few hours later. They never even talked to local election officials, who have since then been sort of scrambling to say, hey, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense for us. We can't even get poll workers to work at the hours you want us to fill the days. It's just the latest in a long series of these. Are very cynical, but they'll stand there with smiling faces and tell you it's all about doing the right thing. But we all know what it's about. It's about cynically depressing the vote of people they don't want to vote.
I don't like the way that it's done, and I think clearly anytime you have these things, you know, as Rob said, something proposed. I mean, I think that bill came out at midnight last night. The committee meeting was this morning to look at this. I certainly can't endorse the way that things are done. You know, as far as some of these voting changes, I think it's important to remember, and I found this really recently because I've looked at this, voter turnout and who votes. And what the data suggests is a lot of these voting regulations, voting changes, when you can vote, how you can vote, make it more convenient for people who choose to vote. The percentage of voters who turn out has not changed. I mean, you know, it was not too long ago in North Carolina that we had one voting day. You know, you voted on election day. The percentage of voters who turn out to vote has remained pretty consistent. Now, granted, having early voting, having these options, having voting on Saturday and Sunday, and, you know, all of the voting places aren't open, but to have certainly options to do that makes it more convenient for people who choose to vote. So I don't think that, you know, the whole notion of voter suppression and people aren't able to vote and they're not going to vote because of these changes, I think any confusion is not good for the system. But I think people who are consistent voters, and unfortunately, it's not a large percentage of the voters, even in a big election year. I mean, I think it's like 60% is a high turnout in those primaries. And some of those, you know, we're looking at 10, 12%. So to say that this is suppressing voters, I don't think that's accurate. I think that it makes it less convenient. I think it makes it confusing. I don't think that's good. But is it going to have a big overall effect on the upcoming election? I don't think so.
69% of registered voters turned out in 2016 for the general election, 44% in the 2014 midterm. Did you have something else?
No, I was just going to say, again, there is no voting change, no election law change, no redistricting change passed in the General Assembly in which the people behind it don't know exactly what they expect the effect to be. And anybody that thinks that the Republicans behind this bill don't expect it to benefit their party in the November election are kidding themselves.
Sure. My follow-up here to this would be, why? Why move this Saturday? This isn't something we've heard from the Board of Elections. This isn't something we've heard from the counties, that it's a problem, that it's cumbersome, that it's costly. The why. And I will put, we didn't hear that in a House Rules Committee Thursday morning. Do either of you want to weigh in on the, you've already weighed in on the why. Is there a why to this? Is there a functional why, or is it a political why, as Rob asserts?
I think a lot of these election law changes are politically driven, and they're driven by the party that's in charge. And we saw changes when the Democrats were in charge that favored their voters. Now that Republicans are in charge, we see changes that presumably appeal to their voters. I think this is the political animal that we deal with. I don't know how you get around that necessarily. The people that are in charge are the ones that are in charge of making the rules around elections, and they're going to make those rules to benefit themselves. It's just a political react. It's ugly. It's unfair. You know, those of us that work in policy can argue it all day long, but the reality of it is we live in a political world.
Anything that gets more people to vote is better. I still say that we had a system that was getting more people to vote, and we've ratcheted back on that, and therein lies the problem.
Elsewhere, heated debate pitting individual property owners against protections for farmers played out in the House on the floor. Ultimately, the Farm Act, for now, went to the manure pile. Several Republicans spoke out passionately against this measure. What is your takeaway from this debate and where this bill stands right now?
Well, where we know it stands right now is it's still up in the air. The Senate passed it, went over to the House. The House has made changes. The Senate would have to confer with this. Can they get this done before this deadline they have set for themselves by the end of the week, get it to the governor for him to make a decision on it? If he vetoes it, do they have the votes to override it? I mean, that's kind of logistically where the bill is. It's been a really interesting debate, I think, on this whole notion of property rights for individuals versus property rights for farmers. You know, as North Carolina grows, as the pressure becomes more and more food, as our farms grow geographically, which is what we want, I think. I mean, we want businesses to grow in North Carolina. We want them to prosper. We want them to employ more people. We want them to pay more taxes, you know, all of those kind of things. As they grow and our population of residents grow, and a lot of people are choosing to live in rural areas. They like that kind of country farm life and are choosing to move their families to those communities. The pressure between those two gets greater and greater. How are we going to solve that? What are we going to do about this? This debate on the farm bill, I think, has brought that really to the forefront. And whether this bill passes, what happens with it, I think that discussion and that problem, those options, how do we find a compromise, is going to continue to be something that we're going to talk about. As important as agriculture is in North Carolina, we're going to continue to talk about this.
I'm sure we will, but we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that these are not just family farms. These are corporate-owned industrial hog factories that we're really talking about with respect to the nuisance suits. Giant corporations have gone to the legislature. They said, we don't want these nuisance suits coming against us, because even though we're making life intolerable for the people who live nearby, and juries have found that, we don't want courts and judges ruling against us and putting big verdicts against us. And they're literally going to the legislature and saying, change the law so we can't be sued. And that's what the hog farm part is about. And with respect to the issue, debate about milk, that's also an issue of corporations going to the legislature and trying to get the law changed to favor their product in the marketplace. And so it's big agribusiness flexing its muscle, and it remains to be seen whether they'll be successful.
Before we go, budget tweaks also breezed through the chambers this week. Lawmakers restored funding to a suicide prevention hotline that was accidentally left out of the budget, lifted a $200,000 earmark for school supplies. It was designed to help a Republican senator in a competitive district, but it was pulled after public pushback from the nonprofit charged with directing the money. Also, $27 million went for veterans' homes, one in the Triangle, one in the Triad. One good budget fix, if there was one, that came this week, Rob.
Fixing the suicide line was clearly something that had to be done. I mean, but in general, this was just, you know, another testament to the fact that the budget was passed without the opportunity to even offer amendments, which was just a preposterous way to pass the budget. So they were bound to come back and do something like this. But even this process was, again, the things rolled out. It's written behind closed doors. It's not really an open process. So, you know, great that they made some fixes, but it doesn't solve the overriding problem here with the way the budget was passed.
Of course, we have this every year. We always have a budget technical corrections bill that goes back and looks at things. I think it's important to recognize that there was no more money was allocated. It was just shifting some things around. Some priorities had been recognized. The suicide hotline, which they had was being funded with federal money, that seemed to be, I don't think anybody meant for that to happen. It was just a miscommunication that happened. But Jeff, in answer to your question about what was good in that, I think that donating some money, putting some money for sex trafficking victims and helping them is something that has been critical. It's a critical need. We need to really start looking at that, and this technical corrections bill does that.
Becky Gray is Senior Vice President with the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is Director of NC Policy Watch. Enjoy your weekend.
Thanks, Jeff.